Welcome to the IVM Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Drinks and Destinations Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Drinks and Destinations Podcast. I'm your host Rajita and my co-host is Samira. And today in our studio, we have two very special guests who've traveled long way from Austria and Germany.
You know, we are very naughty guests also. I think Rajita, they're trying our best to make us laugh.
I know, and we have to put up a serious face. Yes. And obviously.
So who are these brats?
Okay, let me start with the first one. It's Mr. Bernhard Schaffer. I'm pronouncing it correct, right, Bernhard?
Yeah.
He's still not happy. Okay. And the second guest is Arthur Nagele.
Perfect.
Thank you so much. So Bernhard is from... So I'm sticking to only the first names, not the surnames, because they're very difficult to pronounce.
He has a surname. I call him Bernhard, a.k.a. Silver Cuff. Cuff.
Okay.
Because he wears this... No, what is it?
And Silver Ear.
Silver Ear. Okay.
Because he wears this ear cuff all the time.
Oh, and that looks really fancy.
From the time he was born.
No. Roughly.
All right. Okay, so both of them are spirits experts. Arthur is a trainer, speaker, advisor for alcoholic beverages, and he's a very well-known name in the spirits world. And Bernhard is the master of Quaish and cognac educator. Both of them are a part of the European network of spirits experts.
So welcome, guys. And first up, I would like to ask you, what brings you to India?
An airplane.
Apart from that,
spirits.
So what are you here for, a particular reason?
We were both invited for a spirit competition, so we judged spirits and wines and alcoholic beverages in general.
So how was it? Did you try a lot of Indian spirits and beers and wines as well? How was it?
Yeah, we had about 120 products in 2 days.
Yep.
It's been very, very interesting overall to see the spirits categories and the wine, mm-hmm. especially the quality improvement of the red ones.
Mm. And we had brandy and rum.
Oh, nice.
Don't forget the vodka.
Yes.
So where do you see the Indian spirits standing in the international market? When you taste all these varieties of spirits, I'm sure from the cheap categories to premium categories, where do you see these brands standing in the international market?
I think, first of all, compared to the last years, because it's the third time now we're here, the gap between premium and super premium, or in general, all the gaps between those categories getting smaller. Mm-hmm. Quality keeps up. I think internationally, it's the whiskey that stands out.
Yeah.
Two big producers, but I think
the vodka as well. The first strange thing is that you divide things by popular, premium, super premium category. In a competition in Europe, it would be different.
Yeah.
It would be, well, vodkas, for example, you have them at 40%, then you have the higher strength one, but usually you don't have a discrimination between popular or
so it's not on the basis of price,
no,
but on the basis of the alcohol.
Yeah,
basis
on the alcohol, on the ingredient or on the production. So you have, for example, you have craft vodka sometimes, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So and that's somehow the beauty. You don't care about the price. You just get all the vodkas with 40 ABV.
No, I think it's a good idea.
ABV.
Yeah. Yeah, it's much better to do it that way.
And that's what we discovered at the end. I think there is, in a blind tasting, not really a big difference between popular, premium, and super premium.
Mm-hmm.
Quality's there. Doesn't, especially with vodka, doesn't smell a lot.
Yeah, vodka is very difficult to judge.
Quite neutral.
Yeah,
you're looking for the most neutral one.
Yeah, that's true. And I would like to tell my listeners that Bernhard and Arthur, both of them have been my colleagues in spirits competitions that we participate every year. And first one was in China and second one was in Mexico, where we tasted a lot of different varieties of spirits. And sometimes when we are tasting spirits in a blind tasting, there are a lot of things that, you know, we have to take in account. So I'm going to ask both of you to tell us a little bit about how exactly blind tastings for spirits work.
You close your eyes. No, that's a joke. Well, the first thing is you just have the product. You don't know the brand, nothing about the producer, nothing. So you just have, let's say, 10 different vodkas.
Yeah.
So that's the principle of a blind tasting. The only thing you usually know is the ABV.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Technically seen, you get 10 glasses probably, or 15 glasses.
Mm-hmm.
just with a code, 3-digit code on it, and you know the category, which might be vodka, 40 ABV.
Yeah.
And then you pick the best ones. Well, you go through, you look at them, you smell them, you taste them, you look how balanced they are, and then you give points.
And the important thing is you don't... You spit them out.
Yeah, don't drink them.
And I think that's one thing not a lot of people know about tasting. Like, if someone is, you know, talking about tasting, they just think, oh, wow, it's a great job because you get to go and just drink all the alcohol. So it's very important.
If you would drink it after the fifth, everything would be fine.
Right.
And I think that's also on our Facebook pages, one of the most comments, whoa, what about your liver?
Our liver
is very healthy because we never ever swallow, we always spit.
So. You know, I get this question so often. Everybody asks me, if you're tasting 50, 60 wines a day or maybe so many spirits, 25 to 30 spirits in a session like that, then how do you manage? I mean, how can you drink so much? Like, because we don't drink at all when we're tasting, and that's how we behave.
To be honest, we like the badass image.
we are trained to spit, of course, but sometimes you have products your body tells you
you can't
directly
spit it.
You have to spit it. Your body does it.
Of course.
What about the ones you like? Do you like choose not to spit them out?
No.
The ones we like, probably we take the glass apart and drink it afterwards.
And after we finish the entire tasting of the, you know, all these categories of spirits, then we take that glass and go around and say cheers to all other friends, and then we drink it.
That's like a very fun job to me. That's quite rare. Yeah. And it's not more than one.
Yeah.
All right.
And usually that happens when we're giving a gold or a grand gold to
golds,
a...
Yeah, grand gold.
You have to consider that usually the people who bring the spirits in pay for that. So we as judges are responsible for a good quality.
Right.
So we cannot just have fun. Oh, ah, that's nice, that's alcohol. Yeah. So we have a responsibility to give our best to judge their stuff.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's very important to put it out there, like, what really, like, when you're going out to a competition, you're not really drinking it, you're spitting it out, and you're tasting it. But coming back, let's start from the beginning. Where did both your journeys start? You both are great experts in your own field. So I want each of you to tell me, like, the deciding moment when you're like, this is what I'm going to do.
I worked in a bar for roughly 15 years. And by that, I became more and more acquainted to alcohol, of course. We made cocktails. We had a very big selection of alcohol, of whiskeys especially. So, and I became a keeper of the quake due to that. And then I was invited to the first competition because people thought, hey, this guy is probably quite good.
Right.
So you had a kind of little exam and you proved yourself if it's correct. And so it went on. And this was, well, 20 years ago.
At which age did you start?
What?
At which age did you start?
5.
Really?
Okay. No, that's not legal.
No, I'm very old. I'm very old.
No, you're even only my earring 25.
Is my, yeah, thank you. Even my earring is older than you.
And what about you, Arthur?
Well, going a little bit deeper, I've been brought up, my father was a fruit farmer. And therefore, we had our own pot still, and I always helped him in the distillery. So it's
so he started at 5.
Absolutely. It's literally in my cradle, put in my cradle. And I always had to help my father, and, you know, big oak casks, and I had to go inside and shrub it. And that was my first steps. And then I also went the route doing a school for tourism and gastronomy, worked at the bar for a long time, and finally, that's where I picked up single malt whiskies and get more into the thing, educated myself more.
I mean, considering all these tasting stuff, is to a certain extent you can be trained, and after that extent, I think you have to have some talent to do it.
So exactly.
It's not a job for everyone, you know.
So when you say that you have to train, which means that you have to train your nose, your palate, and your obviously your, you know, the experience actually adds a lot to that, I believe. Don't you think so?
It does, but getting back, there is a film you all know. You know Ratatouille?
Yes, yeah,
okay.
Of course.
And the title of the book is Everyone Can Cook.
Yeah.
It's about the same with tasting. Everyone can taste, but
yeah.
It's only about 12% that really can go back to a product and describe it the same way. So if you serve 10 people a drink, they're all very cheerful and can talk about it. But if you serve them 20 drinks and twice the same, only 12% can go back and describe it the same way.
Oh, we have the same thing in the space competition as well, right? We are given the same brand twice in the same flight, so that, you know, you have the same score and you're experiencing the same spirit in your glass and you understand it.
It's exactly a very good way of getting rid of judges.
Yeah, exactly.
But because you ask for training, well, you don't train your smelling sense. The sense is always basically the same. What you train is remember things, having words for it and remember that.
Yeah, that's important.
Smelling is a very, very powerful sense. Most people underestimate that.
Absolutely.
You don't have to train the smelling. You have to train finding the right words attached to what you smell.
Yeah.
I think that's the point.
Yeah, that's very important.
And then bring it down to the paper. Mm-hmm. And especially if you do it not only in your own language, how to translate it.
Yeah. You know, sometimes when we do these tastings, as we're talking about relating the smells to a particular thing, the kind of theoretical words that are attached to different smells when we taste a certain kind of spirits or wine, sometimes I don't relate to them because I have been grown up in a different environment where the country is different. I have been brought up with a different kind of food and drinks habits. But I relate to some other things that I might have tasted. Like, you know, usually sometimes in Sauvignon Blanc, I get the kind of raw custard apple notes, which, you know, in Europe or any other part of the world, people might not understand. But I mean, say that, you know, I have actually tasted the raw custard apple and I know how it tastes like.
Yeah.
And so it's strange.
It's also a cultural thing, of course.
Yeah.
Because if you describe something as garam masala and somebody from southern Spain, what's that? You know,
right.
Of course.
They understand it as sweet spice.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
But I'm wondering, doesn't that kind of help, like when you have judges coming from different parts of the world?
Exactly.
It kind of broadens the way you can describe something and gives...
In general, yes, I think so. But keep in mind, some of them are not that open-minded. So sometimes they think they have to conquer what they think and only...
Kind of
their approach is the right one.
And that's exactly why they have a standard module, so that everyone sticks to the same style and format and not everybody is going haywire with their own perception about a drink. So, yeah.
But before we get to that point, I think it's quite necessary to point out it's not all just discussing it. There are certain ideas of what is a whiskey, what is a rum, what is a gin.
Yep.
Exactly.
And it's from A to Z. You can't go further. So... You only can narrow it down, but not broaden the whole range. So I think it's not just general discussion about a product. There are guidelines, there are frameworks.
I mean, the first thing you're looking for is usually if there's a fault in it. Does it fit into a category?
Yeah.
You have something called brandy, so you expect a certain brandy taste, flavor, smell.
And if wine, grapes.
Yeah, whatever. Even more.
Yeah.
I mean, you said Sauvignon Blanc. Well, I don't like it at all. That's the reason why I can pick it out very easily.
Mm.
Okay? So it's cat's pee for me, mostly.
And that's described as cat's pee, actually. Yeah. You know, that note sometimes.
Is
that you get
translated
in
into custard apple?
No. But the kind of Sauvignon Blanc I'm talking about...
They have strange cats in this country.
Strange cats.
But the Sauvignon Blanc that we have, they have these green vegetal notes and those... give you the custard apple notes anyway. So you've been to a lot of competitions all over the world. So which are the competitions that you feel, I mean, if you don't want to name them, it's okay, but you can say that, you know, which are the ones which you think are doing the best thing, right thing, basically?
We are not going to tell any names.
Okay.
But I think the ones we are visiting, if they don't do a good job, they won't be there for long.
Mm-hmm.
So... there is in certain countries or certain markets, there is a need for a competition. And if the competition doesn't fill that need, they won't be there for long. Therefore, it's separating on its own.
Yeah. People who make competitions are always in a problematic situation. First, they want to have quality and would like to recognize and give medals to quality. But if you're too strict, you don't have enough medals.
Yeah.
So on the other hand, the producers bring their products in, they want medals. So if you are too generous with medals, the quality of the competition is not very good.
Yeah.
So it's always a balanced thing, you know. So for example, I know of one competition, usually they say above, let's say we have a 100% scale, a 100-point scale, and usually they say above 75, it's a bronze medal, above 85, it's a gold medal. But they also have a thing that they say, we give away only 30% medals. 1,000 products, only 300 are able to receive medals. Mm. Now imagine that you have 400 products with 85 points. Just So then they say, okay, we can't do that. We augment the points you need for a medal.
Yeah.
So they become more stricter, mm-hmm. just to have the gap, this capping of 30%.
Mm. I think that's a system that works quite well.
Yeah. Which at the end it might be a little bit unfair to the product if you raise the bar during the tasting. Either it is a set bar or it is not. Mm-hmm. But I think you wanted to hear some names. I think in each and every country there are good competitions.
Yeah.
But there are only two international ones that raise the bar.
Well, maybe three. But it doesn't matter. The thing is, I don't have a problem with raising the bar. As Arthur correctly said, if a competition is not good in the long run, they will just go away. They will just, or the medal is not worth anything. So,
mm-hmm. All right, we're getting the serious discussion zone. So let's go on a short break, and when we come back, we talk more with Arthur and Banhar. Stay tuned.
It was rated Goregaon's most intelligent podcast. It was the best new podcast of the day when it was launched. And now, the irreverent brand of attempted humor and botched education is coming your way. You have many burning questions.
So what is the Brexit? What do mathematicians do, man? I mean...
Introducing Simplified, a weekly podcast that deconstructs issues around you, such as, what on earth is Bitcoin?
So Bitcoin is just another currency like the rupee or dollar. The difference here is it's a virtual currency.
Do resolutions in cameras really matter?
They think that just because a number is higher, what they're getting is actually more.
And encryption.
So encryption, okay, it's a process of encoding messages in such a fashion that only the intended recipient sees it in its intended format.
Hosted by Narendra Shanoy, a very wise man who can't stop making P.G. Woodhouse references. And Deepak Gopalakrishnan, who calls himself Chuck, a madman who can't stop making poor jokes.
Narendra, what do you call a forest where you find all the latest news?
Uh-oh, I don't have a good feeling about
that. A topical rainforest.
Follow Chuck and Arain as they scour Google and read Wikipedia for you and condense it into language you can understand. Simplified, helping you appear smarter to an audience that knows no different.
All right, welcome back. And today is a fun day, special day. We have Arthur and Bernard with us. And I'm going to go ahead and ask you, what are your favorite spirits? I'll start with you, Arthur.
Okay, well... I don't have the freedom to have a favorite spirit at all. If someone asks me, no, a good answer is always, it always depends on the day of time, the daytime and the occasion.
Yeah, so let's start from breakfast to dinner.
From breakfast to dinner? Yippee-yay. No, I generally try to not drink any spirits before 5.
Oh, well.
But remember,
thank you for saying that. Now this episode can always go on air.
It's always 5 o'clock somewhere. So. Personally, if I need something refreshing, I go for a gin tonic.
Okay.
Gin is one of my big laughs. And if I want something to sit and sip with friends, I tend to go for a single malt whiskey or for a rum. So that's my preferences. What about you?
He's doing my job. Come on.
Well... The answer was, what is my favorite drink? Mm-hmm. Well, it's the one you pay. No,
you must be going on a lot of dates then.
It really depends on. I mean, if I'm sitting in a coffee in Germany in the summertime, well, there is summer in Germany sometimes. I love to sit there with a Ricard, for example, which is a anise drink with some water and ice. But generally in the evening, like Arthur, I'm very big in gin, but he dilutes it with tonic. Mm-hmm. I diluted it with Angostura bitters and some ice. So it's called Bing Gin. That's my typical, all my Facebook pages always, things like that. And of course whiskey and rum.
All right.
And then some whiskey maybe, and occasionally a rum.
A rum.
Yeah.
So
you talk about whiskey.
Yeah, well,
and rum.
Yeah, yeah, you have to swallow down the rum with some whiskey. Then. No, but what he said is not drinking before five. I mean, although we're making it a little bit funny now, it's drinking in moderation, more quality than quantity.
Right. You know?
So we're talking not every day.
Not every day.
Every night, maybe. No.
We're talking about gin. Yes. And I know, even I love gin, and especially the gins which are very high on the juniper note and herbs and, you know, different botanicals which are really strong enough. And I like it with tonic water. Tell me about this big gin comeback which has happened in the last few years, especially in Europe. And I've seen that in London quite a lot, like bars and restaurants and mixologists. They're trying a lot of gin cocktails. And what do you have to say about the story behind gin's big comeback?
Well, I think you're getting two different answers. One from the production view, one from the drinker's view.
No? Go for it.
Well, see, I think the big rush behind gin, the last big rush behind gin is about 10 years back. It started somewhat 10 years back with distillers that were not at all into gin. It's been Germany, it's been afterwards Austria and Switzerland, it's been fruit distillers that always have been allowed to produce kind of juniper spirit or herbal spirits, and that came along the idea, why not producing a gin? Because it's not as cumbersome as fermenting fruits and distilling fruits. And first big thing was
Bombay Sapphire.
That was the international one, yeah.
Basically, Bombay were those people who started the craze a little bit, and then came Hendrix. I mean, you refer to
the 80s. Back in the 80s.
A bit later then. But this was from his production side, the one thing, my opinion, but please correct me as you are producing things. I mean, it's very easy making gin. You need a good recipe and you need a distiller. So if we four say, hey, let's make a good gin, we can start tomorrow. And end of next week, we have the bottle on the market.
Wow. But the thing is, all the gin...
post our recording today.
So the gin
producers... Okay, so we fix here, we do a drinks and distillation
gin. Yeah,
let's
all miss our flights and just do this, make some gin.
The best part is all these gin producers, they're very secretive about their botanicals, the ingredients.
Yeah,
they don't share their recipes
with anyone. That's the only thing that separates from the others. There are some common ingredients like juniper and angelica root and coriander and citrus peels, but usually the signature botanicals, they stand out, and the rest they keep in the shadow.
For example, Hendrix is very different from your Bombay Sapphire, or Tanqueray is very different from,
or my favorite too, which is Beefeater.
I love Beefeater as well. That's very regular, basic, but I actually prefer Hendrix more than Beefeater, but still.
Well, I think we should try to get in a timeline. He mentioned Bombay Sapphire, which was the first big new premium gin after a long time
where nothing happened.
Gin was forgotten. We had a big rush of gin during Prohibition in the US when people could produce gin in the bathtub. So they simply soaked the botanicals in alcohol. And when someone from the tax office came, they just pulled and drained down the whole thing. So they just let out the bath. That's the idea behind bathtub gin.
And it was not this good.
No, it was harsh.
Of course.
It was not that palatable, but it wasn't redistilled. It's
not
just
filtered,
been soaked botanicals. And then the hype went on through all that 50s and 60s
with the Dramatinis,
cocktail thing, and Hollywood pushed it quite a lot. And in the 80s, it was Smirnoff that ended the whole boom. It was vodka coming up, and then end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, probably it was
the Bombay people thought they should do something new now, and so they had this fancy bottle and they did things for bartenders and developed new recipes, and it slowly walked and crawled on. And then Hendrix was the big pusher with a total new thing to gin. I mean, it was, they added this cucumber thing, for example, and rose petals, and this was new. And it's, I mean, nowadays still, if you have different gins. Most people drink it as gin tonic. I mean, I don't know how it is here, but if you go to a bar in Europe,
yeah,
mainly,
in Martinis as well. Yeah, mostly
you go to a bar in Europe, usually you said, well, 15 years ago, you said, hey, I'd like to have a gin tonic, and then they made a gin tonic. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, they ask, oh, which type of gin you would like to have, and which type of the different 10 tonics we have. It's like Starbucks, you know. Yeah. You said you want a coffee, and there are 20 different varieties, and you, no.
Yeah, and there's suddenly gin bars coming up all across the world. In fact,
they pass you on the gin menu with up to 120 positions, and when you made your way through the gin, they ask you, which tonic do you want?
Yeah.
And I think for most of the consumers, that's the point where they are totally confused because they don't know the difference.
But I think I've also heard that your G&T is as good as your tonic is. So you have to be very careful about what kind of tonic also you
choose. Well, see, I think the first point is you work your way through gins and find your perfect gin. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing is you decide on which tonic, because a tonic is the mixer. It's usually double or three times of the gin. Mm-hmm. And when you then have set which gin and which tonic, the next thing is even a garnish will
absolutely
totally change it. Lemon, grapefruit, lime, everything is a different
aroma.
Or
even cucumbers.
Yeah.
Well, I get approached a lot with that cucumber stuff. I think the only reason to take cucumber into a gin tonic is if you do it with the gin, which is a prime to it. So there is no sense in adding cucumber to other gins because that's really made for that particular gin.
So you have to keep in mind what kind of ingredients are there in your gin, and then on the basis of that you can decide.
I mean, the boom in Europe started mainly also in Spain, because it's a big gin drinking nation, and they serve the gin tonic not in a long drink glass, but usually a big wine gobbly.
Oh, okay.
So in Germany, probably the same in Austria and Switzerland, usually when you order gin tonic, you have a long drink glass, ice cubes, gin, and you receive a bottle tonic aside.
Mm-hmm.
So you add your tonic. So in the beginning, it's stronger,
mm-hmm.
and it goes weaker and weaker as you add more tonic. In Spain, in the wine gobelé, there's enough space for everything.
Yeah.
So they just put everything into it, so it's always the same strength. Well, the ice is diluting it a bit, but more or less. And they do also, they're adding things with a different garnishes. So that's a different way of doing it, which I basically prefer.
I like that too.
Yeah.
In fact, the glass looks literally lovely when you have that in the goblet glass.
Well, my problem is usually that it's far too much tonic in. Then if you have 4 centiliters of gin and you add 250 ml
I have a solution for that. I add then Art Baker 10.
that's a good one. But let's go back.
Comes back.
Also, to kind of understand what you're saying is that there needs to be a little more awareness about the different gin and tonics. Like, a lot of options have come up, but people are not really aware what to go for.
Yeah, but in Europe, it's going over the top at the moment. Okay. I mean, I'm bored if somebody asks me all these questions.
Right.
That's the reason why I'm drinking pink gin. But I think, I don't know how it's in India, but in Europe, it's the peak probably is reached, or even it's a little bit over the top already.
We've just started, actually. Last 2-3 years back, gin has picked up in India.
It's interesting
but I don't think
to see those waves.
For choice here as of
We have like most of the very popular gin brands in India, but we don't have like 100 or 200 brands. We used to have a gin bar in India at JW Marriott Hotel called Arula, specifically only for gin lovers. So that's one thing that will happen.
Well, I think the point is, we mentioned some brands that pushed the trend, and then the small scalers came up. That's why it, especially in the German language areas, we have such a boom.
Yeah.
And I think after those, or when going over the peak now, we can really say it's not been something consumers asked for. It's been something that's been pushed by the producers.
Okay. You started celebrating a World Gin Day, in fact, just a couple of
years
back,
isn't everything
it?
There. But the interesting thing is that the real gin boom only now approaches Britain.
Yeah, yeah.
They started it with some brands. It went to Spain. It went to Germany, Austria, Switzerland. And only now they themselves
revived.
Say...
Well, the last 2 or 3 years, probably.
Yes.
But the next step already happened, that some big companies are buying some successful smaller producers.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the first one and the most premium one, and we can say it here, is Monkey 47.
Mm-hmm.
That's a brand brought up by by two guys in Germany about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they really went from scratch, from nothing, to the top. And they've been the first craft product, mm-hmm. boutique
product. We have to admit, with a really very high quality. I mean, yeah. they both knew their business.
Been taken over by international big player. Yes. Pernod Ricard.
Pernod Ricard. And wow. Sipsmith, which is a smaller distillery in London, starting with gin. Now, I think Diageo is in it.
Diageo took it over. So they see there are craft, there mm-hmm. are boutique, there are niche producers, and the better they are, the bigger they build their brand, they are now taken over by the big ones.
What I personally, concerning whiskey, really like to see is that we had these two brands, real single malts, which are very, very high standard yeah. quality. So what I think, what I saw is, yes, this country is able of making very good spirit.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think we shouldn't put any barriers or boundaries where there are no ones in India. It's just very curious for us to come in tasting brandy and got told it's not necessarily that they are made of grape. Yeah. Because where we come from, a brandy is always made from grapes mm-hmm. or from wine. And a whiskey is always made from cereals mm-hmm. or grain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not from molasses. But at the end, I think it's the point to see what's the quality of the spirit.
Yeah.
Everything else is not our goal.
So we were talking about gin and a lot of other spirits. Now I want to talk about this very interesting drink called absinthe. I know that Arthur specializes in absinthe, and this is something that a lot of people want to know. Is it really true that absinthe actually, you know, lets you hallucinate? What about the green fairy, and how exactly you should be drinking it? Let's just ask Arthur about it.
I can see his facial expressions change. I want to tell our listener.
He's so happy to talk about it.
The green fairy, or absinthe, or however you call it, is a product that originates in Switzerland. So that's why I know a little bit more about it. It's literally made the same way than gin. It's an aromatized spirit. Instead of juniper and coriander and citrus peels you use for gin, mm-hmm. you use wormwood, which is the plant with the tuyon in it. There are two different kind of that herb, mm-hmm. big, the great, the small one. And then they sometimes also use fennel anise as part of the recipe. And, you build your recipe, you soak it in alcohol. The difference to gin is usually you macerate with gin, the botanicals in the cold alcohol, and leave it there for 2, 3, 4 days, and then you distill it with absinthe usually. You fill the alcohol into the pot still, and then the night before you're going to distill it, you're warming it up to around 50 degrees, and then you soak the botanicals, all the herbs, in the warm alcohol during the night. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why there are no more very old distilleries, or only less of the old distilleries, because, you know, at 78.5, 78.3, the alcohol starts evaporating.
It's really high. Yeah, right.
And whenever the alcohol evaporates and the pot still is open, the alcohol fume will arise and settle under the ceiling. And the first one in the morning that puts on the light is the one with the two on the back. So it will lighten up, it will explode, and that's a way quite a lot of the distilleries burned down.
Wow. Oh, that's scary.
It's a product that started in the Swiss part, and I think more and more people picked up the taste for it. It went from craft to industry, as always, and the more they produced, they went towards the border into France, because the taxes have been quite low there. Mm-hmm. So they moved to Pontarlier, produced big quantities of absinthe that time. And no, the question is, no, you're not going crazy when you drink absinthe.
Because that's what we've read. Everywhere.
Yeah, like there's so much controversy that surrounds absinthe. And why is that the case?
We have a good friend of us that that deals with pre-ban absinthe. So mm-hmm. If we talk about ban originating from Switzerland throughout Europe and the world from 1911 onwards, they started banning or prohibiting absinthe mm-hmm. because there was a Swiss farmer that drank all night obviously wine and beer. And the last thing people saw is drinking absinthe, him drinking absinthe. And then he went home and killed both children and the wife.
That's horrible.
With an axe.
With an axe, yeah. Wow. So that's the point where they really started trying to ban it.
Oh, but that I'm sure that had very little to do with absinthe. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely.
Like, it's just a story that started.
Well, they created the story
blamed
about
for it.
Right. Yeah, he was hallucinating, and that's why he took the eggs and killed the whole
that's
family.
That's like taking a small story like really way too far.
Yeah,
too
it's
actually.
Just like
it is.
More to do with the person or being an alcoholic.
And at the end, most people believe it's been the wine industry that pushed the whole thing because no one drank wine anymore. Back to that friend that has that pre-ban absinthe from before 1911, they put it to the lab, and in the original absinthe, there hasn't been any more Tuyone in than the EU now wants the producers not to exceed. So there was never a high level of Tuyone being there for hallucination. I think it's more the bad alcohol, the drinking habit of drinking far too much of that stuff. And then at the end, as we are talking about the green fairy, that green color usually comes from a coloring. So you distill the absinthe and then you take part of it and again macerate it with melissa and small wormwood to get in the color. So it's a natural color. But during those industrial times, they haven't had time for that part. And it's talk about that some of the distillers only used copper to make it green. So when you add up all those things, too much alcohol, bad quality alcohol, and copper, strongest liver will die.
Yeah, of course. But what is the best way to drink absinthe?
Well, there are three ways to drink absinthe, but in general it's divided to the Swiss French one and the Bohemian one. Swiss French one, you use those water fountains.
Yeah.
So there is ice and water. And the saying is that the slower you put in the water, the highly aromatic the drink gets. And it's, again, come from France during that green hour, l'heure verte. There was people, usually veterans from the war, disabled people in the back rooms called absinthiers, and they got some money from the richer people and prepared that absinthe drop by drop with water.
Wow.
That's also the way it's still drunk, but people do drop the water in themselves. The Bohemian way is a far sweeter way. You need those absinthe spoons, and they have holes in them.
Cube of sugar.
Yeah, cube of sugar on top of it. Then you put the alcohol above the sugar into the glass, and then you lighten up the sugar.
You stop that's the whole what thing. We have seen, actually. Everywhere.
You stop the whole thing, either if you believe it's getting too sweet or you're worried about your alcohol evaporating with the fire. So you stop the whole thing with adding water. But it's very sweet. And looking at the cuisine here, I'm pretty sure that's the way the Indians do it.
But we are not allowed to sell those absinthe with 70 degree, alcohol in India.
Yeah.
It has
about
to be
before.
Only less than 50 degrees.
I see. Yeah, so that's not a good thing for absinthe because there is lots of anise in and the essential oils.
Yeah.
In the bottle, it's clear, and that's because of the high alcohol contents. And when you add water, it loses, so it gets milky, cloudy, and that's a quality thing. When it's not getting cloudy, you can think about it that the product is made up of alcohol and just essences instead of
inferior quality.
Yeah, inferior quality.
But there are absinthe which are below 50 degrees as well, right? Or maybe around 55?
55.
Yes, around 50. It starts around 55, going up even to 75.
I mean, if you want to get an easy idea how it basically tastes, you have to buy anise from France, pastis.
I have a bottle of pastis. I've tried it. Oh, my God, pastis is really heavy.
Well, see, pastis...
I mean, it's sweet, but alcohol is so
depending
high.
On the brand. But pastis, as Arthur wants to say, was basically invented by these people who were not allowed to produce absinthe anymore. So
right.
So you would say it's kind of a substitute for it.
very successful
absolutely.
One.
They took out the wormwood and worked around with different other herbs. And that's how pastis came to life. Yeah.
But pastis is very popular in France, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there was a Monsieur Pernod and a Monsieur Ricard, and they both produced this stuff.
Yeah, that's right. So that was a really intense conversation about absinthe and gin and spirits, other spirits, and how to taste spirits in competitions. And what do you think, Samira? What did you learn today?
I'm very intrigued. I learned about the various gin and tonics coming up. I learned the great absinthe story, which was very interesting.
That's
and
very
intriguing.
Fascinating, isn't it?
Yes. And I'm looking forward to having them back again in India very soon with some more exciting episodes. What do you say, guys?
Well, vice versa. Whenever you come to Europe, you should stop over.
Oh, yes, definitely.
We're going to show you some distilleries and
bring your microphone.
Yeah, I think that would be brilliant.
Trust me, we'll try our best to bring the microphone and make a great episode out of it.
One stop in Austria, one stop in Germany, and we'll sort it.
Sounds like a good summer plan to me, Rojita. What do you
think? Summer is very good,
pay attention. I will take you across the border to Switzerland.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
I will take you to the countryside with the little breweries, you know.
Thank you so much.
Nice. Thank you so much for the offer. That sounds really interesting. Thank you so much, guys, for being here with us on the studio.
Thank you. It was lovely chatting.
It was a pleasure coming here. Thanks very much.
Yes.
And hopefully your stay in India was quite wonderful, and hope to see you guys back
in
India.
It was the very best end I can imagine.
Thank you. Well, that's all we have for the episode today, and stay tuned, and we're coming up with another exciting episode next week. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and SoundCloud. You could also check us out on YouTube on IVM Podcast Network, and you could also follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram as well. And while all of us love our tipple, make sure that you drink
responsibly.
Thank
Bye.
You. Bye.
Our podcasts bring all the boys to the yard, and damn right, they're better than yours. But you don't need to stand outside in the yard. Just follow IVM Podcasts on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We might be on Tinder too. Just go ahead and swipe right.